You're listening to Radio Area.
Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you woke up, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. The date is Thursday, February 7th, 2019. I'm Andy Donner, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
For the blessed warming light, farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely croon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
I need to open this particular episode of Radio Free Northwest with a request. I'll make it brief. Many of you will remember years ago on this program, Harold Covington read out flyers written by someone, one of our comrades in fact, who lives in northern Idaho and who mails these things around to his regional neighbors. They were always good, sure, but lately they've gotten quite a bit better, and I know this because the HQ group and I had the opportunity to read a few of them recently that were returned as undeliverable to the party P.O. box, which he lists as his return address. Lately, as I said, these flyers have been very on point, well-written, focused, and come across as credible and reasonable, which is rare for someone in this thing of ours. Whoever you are out there, well done, comrade. Your work does not go unnoticed. Even so, there's a small hitch. As I said, he is using the party's P.O. box as his return address, and that's the problem. You see, every once in a while, a large batch of these letters will come back as undeliverable and make quite a mess for the HQ group who has to sort through what's going on with these things. Additionally, there will occasionally be a request that we remove someone from this list. The trouble is, we absolutely can't do that because we ourselves don't control this list because we don't do the mailings. Now, comrade, look, every one of us in the HQ group appreciates what you're doing, because your material's good. What we need you to do, though, is either stop doing this or use your own return address, be it a P.O. box or whatever else you care to arrange for yourself. We're starting to get requests to stop mailing people, and it's going to make the party look bad if we don't do that. Now, sure, it's fun to joke about sending this person all sorts of racial propaganda just to annoy them, but the fact of the matter is that we'll not put the party on a credible basis of communication with those in the area, and that will turn into a problem in the long run. So how about it, friend? Either don't do this, or use a return address where you yourself will get the responses. And now on to a brief bit of commentary by me before we get into the show. Firstly, I am crammed for time this week, but that's no surprise. More importantly, though, I was actually asked a very important question by way of comment on a recent Radio Free Northwest episode. By the by, the guy who asks these questions almost always asks amazing questions, and this question is no exception to that pattern. I'm going to do my level best to keep this answer brief, partly because, again, I am short on time, but more importantly because I want the content of the answer to stand on its own as something that is memorable, because it's actually very, very important to everyone, even if they don't know it yet. I should note that I'm unable to verify the premise of the question entirely, in that I am not entirely sure when Harold Covington would have referred to the person in question as what he's alleged to refer to them as, but it sounds mostly right. And I just realize that's not very helpful since I haven't explained what I'm talking about, but I do want to issue a general disclaimer. I'm taking the question itself mostly on face value. Generally speaking, I was asked about a particular white nationalist pseudo-intellectual blogger named Farnham O'Reilly. I want to be frank, I don't have anything against the man personally, since he and I never interacted. If memory serves, he was in northern Idaho or western Montana for a very, very long time, and yes, in fact, that was him who got doxxed some years back. The question specifically pertains to the fact that the guy asking the question very much appreciated Farnum O'Reilly's work and was actually shocked to find that he was on good terms with all of the other pseudo-intellectuals in the white nationalist movement. Well, I've got some news for you there. It's true that on face value, O'Reilly may very well have been a proponent of the Northwest Imperative, but not really. And I say that because many of you will remember a story Harold told about one of his novels containing a certain amount of commercial dirt in the form of raunchy sex scenes, and this is in fact that novel that was distributed with a leaflet, when Harold did the mailing, of course, with a leaflet saying, hey, this is in the novel, if that's going to be a problem, maybe give this one a pass. Harold once told a story about that book being handed off to a particular person, and that person was, in fact, Farnum O'Reilly. I don't care to disparage Mr. O'Reilly, since, quite frankly, he's had a hard enough time, and, as I said, I don't personally have anything against him, except the pseudo-intellectual white nationalism, which is its own variety of white nationalism. You'll note that the Northwest Front itself really doesn't fit into any neat categorization, and that's not because we try to be special or unique or anything like that. We just are special and unique. And by the by, that in and of itself isn't deliberate, it's just a byproduct of actually taking a stance and then acting on it. There are always two ends of the white nationalist spectrum, the skinheads and the eggheads, and we don't fit in either variety. I've been over that before, but we're going to focus particularly on the pseudo-intellectual eggheads. Now you'll note I say pseudo-intellectual because that's what they are. They go on and on and on about various subjects and, quite frankly, will even produce some amazing work at times. I don't deny that. The problem is they believe it just up to the point of acting on it, but not any further. That is the definition of intellectual racism, in that it stays purely intellectual. And unfortunately, if you want to run in those circles, the very first thing that will happen when you actually take a stand for some particular plan of action and actually start promoting it is that you will alienate all your other pseudo-intellectual friends, which is why the pseudo-intellectual scene has always hated the Northwest Front. Everything we've said about white character, pseudo-intellectual racism, outright intellectual racism, theorycraft, and the canard of waking people up all runs together. This is the exact problem with all of that, is that it very much comes to nothing, even of the people who are advocating the intellectual approach to racism. I'm going to use the example of Dr. Kevin MacDonald. Now, again, disclaimer, I have nothing personal against him, except that, well, he done goofed a number of years back, and it was kind of a major, major goof. Here's what I mean. Some of you will be familiar with the Pacific Northwest offshoot of the Mike the Kike Enoch fan club called TRS. This offshoot took the name True Cascadia and made a number of efforts to outright edge the Northwest Front out of white nationalism, including using terminology and slogans we ourselves developed, as well as names and concepts that we've worked on to try and promote the single viable plan to prevent white genocide. Now, again, that's important. The fact of the matter is they didn't care that we worked on developing a brand. They simply wanted to co-opt that brand and get rid of us. This includes, of course, a pool party in Seattle where Greggy Johnson, Grinder Greg as you may have heard him called, ended up harassing underage children. Yeah, great. Way to go. Now the trouble with this, as I said, is that Kevin MacDonald is, again, a very, very smart person that's done a lot of impressive work. I don't deny that. The trouble is, pseudo-intellectual racists are very, very good at dashing their reputations very quickly by associating with people they ought not associate with. At some point, something caused Kevin MacDonald to tweet out a statement of approval for True Cascadia, and up to the point of endorsing that they were the ones doing what people should be trying to do. What about the Northwest Front there, Dr. MacDonald? Now again, this could be an innocent mistake on his part, but he has a standing such that he should not make these mistakes, simply because, again, his reputation is what it is. Now bear in mind that Dr. Kevin MacDonald is an actual intellectual, as opposed to pseudo-intellectuals that run around and read actual intellectuals and pretend that they're, oh, they're political equal or some such thing. How is it that Kevin MacDonald would not be willing to endorse the Northwest Front? Is that too politically hot? Well, as it turns out, it is. The Northwest Front is always too hot for any variety of intellectual racist. And again, that right there is the reason to hate intellectual racists, even if you like some of their material. Okay, this is already going way longer than I want it to, so I will give you the takeaway and shut up. Intellectual racism, by definition, never ever includes manifested, actual, real-world white nationalism. And if you understand that, it will make perfect sense why someone you consider impressive as an intellectual racist could so easily pal around with people who very clearly have nothing to do with actual white nationalism outside of blogs. If I had to boil that down to a single soundbite, it would be this. Intellectual racism or actual white nationalism. They're mutually exclusive.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to be discussing Storm of Steel by Ernst Jünger, and this is a memoir of the First World War. Jünger was born in 1895 in Heidelberg, the eldest of seven children, and he had a tendency, like many young men of his generation, he yearned for adventure, and in 1913 he joined the French Foreign Legion. He was always a very open-minded person, and apparently, according to the editor of this book, he loved both France and also the United States. Now, the German government retrieved him and sent him to the Gildermeister Institute. And by December of 1914, he was on the Western Front. Now, early in the war, Ernst was sent to officer training school, and this meant that he had a somewhat easier time than the rank and file, although he still saw quite a bit of action and, in fact, was wounded on several occasions, often due to shrapnel wounds. And he writes about balancing the rank of being an officer and the privileges of that rank, but also needing to take risks in order to maintain unit cohesion and comradeship with the men under him. Now, I must admit, this is a very compellingly written account, and it is hard to put down. And you really get to see the impossibility of the situation. So this landscape, of course, confusing array of trenches, and the author frequently talks about almost getting lost within the trenches and maybe even accidentally getting behind enemy lines. And suddenly there was starting to be even some use of air power in the First World War, and they were developing more and more in the way of powerful artillery. And everyone had very heavy losses, but eventually what happened is it became more and more obvious that the Central Powers were less equipped to deal with these losses. And the problem was that Britain could draw upon a global empire. And another thing was that Jünger notes that often, at least on the German side, often these decisions were being made by individuals who were not on the front lines themselves. And oftentimes their strategic plans would suffer from a lack of actual on-the-ground knowledge and experience. Now, the author talks about how spring of 1918 was a last-ditch attempt to win. And this author is disappointed, as many of the soldiers were, with the political establishment, and he felt it was not supportive enough of the war effort. Now, Jünger was recognized by most as an excellent writer, and he eventually would win a Goethe Prize. Because Jünger wrote about military subjects, he wound up gaining some clout with the National Socialists. And in fact, in World War II, Jünger was stationed in occupied France. At this point, he was getting a bit on in years, of course, and he had a desk job, and he was courted by the party. In fact, Hitler was fond of his writing, but he ultimately would decline that. And in fact, at one point, he evidently wrote a book called Marble Cliffs, and this was a book that was very much anti-party satire. Even more than that, Ernst was connected to the 1944 assassination plot. And of course, there were severe repercussions for most of the individuals who were anywhere plausibly near that plot. However, when it came to Junger, Hitler was merciful because he had enjoyed Storm of Steel so much. Now, there are some that would critique this book as glorifying war. I would really tend to disagree with that. I mean, it's true that Junger was like many other men of his generation. He did see a great manliness in these contests. But then again, he never shies away from being honest about the brutality of war. Now, there are some who have attempted to peg him as being somehow a National Socialist, but I get the sense that Junger was not ever overly ideological. Indeed, it seems to me that he never loses himself too much in any kind of an ideology, and this likely seems due to what I would consider to be a fairly healthy ego on his part. Now, Junger had an amazingly long life. He only passed on at the age of 102, and towards the very end of his life, he did decide that he would become a Catholic. Now, Ernst was from a generation that was very hierarchical and was military-based, and I suppose you could say that he looked to the grandeur of the old order, and when I say old order, I'm talking about Imperial Germany. He also knew how to care for himself and really survive the historical changes that were going on and taking them all in stride. Now, of course, the July plot that he was supposedly involved in, or certainly he knew a lot of people that were involved in it, that he was suspiciously connected to, that likely failed because avatars really do come and go of their own pleasing. You can think about the story, for example, when Krishna was given poison at one point in one of his incarnations when he was an infant. And of course, the poison didn't work. Or you can look at the death of Guru Gobind Singh when he had severe wounds and he wasn't supposed to pull his bow, and he did so anyway, and he died as a result of that. So anyone who has any kind of even minor avatorial power or inclination, I don't know whether it is possible to assassinate someone like that. And certainly Adolf Hitler, you look at his life, you look at his history in the First World War, he was clearly under divine protection. So this was a request, and that was why I'm discussing this book. And it was interesting. I was captivated by his tale of the First World War, of the Western Front, of what it was like to be in France at that time. And I can see why the French surrendered right away in the Second World War, because they were totally devastated in the First World War. So thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this discussion. Have a good evening and hail victory, comrades.
Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from Arizona, just north of Phoenix. Got to deliver there in the morning, so I just thought I'd throw this one in. Thank you, Andy, for a nice, good episode here on the 17th of January. Spaced repetition is a good thing, and don't mind hearing more wisdom from Harold. Everybody should go and listen to back episodes, but this is one good way to get them to do it. So thank you, Andy and crew, for that. It never ceases to amaze me, the wisdom, insight, and crystal ball gazing that Mr. Covington has done through his books. Once again, he has hit the nail on the head. What am I talking about? It's more of It Takes a Village is trying to be passed into law down there in Oregon. And I guess Governor Inslee up there in Washington is going to try to follow suit. They're going to start invading homes of newborn children to do spot checks on them and their families and give their infinite wisdom on how to raise your kids. Isn't that just lovely? God, I don't know. Managed to raise two halfway decent kids myself without the government's putting their damn camel nose under my tent flaps. But nope, they've got to go and legislate it where it's going to be law that they get to come in and invade your house and your privacy so they can have complete control over you. Yep, 1984 swings back around again. Anyway, so I'll go and throw a link in with this tidbits here, and hopefully they'll have some way to go and put it up in the show notes of the article that I'm referring to, so you can go and read it for yourself. But yeah, it's just ridiculous the amount of oversight that they have to do on us nowadays. And will it ever end? It's doubtful, but they're going to continue. So here you go. Here's a thing from the driver's seat out here on the road. This is the trucker, like I say, coming at you from Arizona. I've been out dodging snowflakes here and there around the country. Now isn't the best time for you to be trying to do your scouting trip or your migration. Seen a lot of trucks in the ditch, a lot of cars slid off the road or remnants thereof. So, yeah, it's probably better to wait until after spring hits and the roads get better and all that. Not that they're real terrible right now, but when you have storm fronts coming in, like hitting this weekend here in Pennsylvania, I guess the governor's talking about shutting down all the interstate roads there to commercial traffic so they don't have to go and have the big trucks sliding off and messing things up, so to speak. But it's usually the cars that cause the initial problem or drivers that really don't know how to drive in it and shouldn't be out on the roads anyway. Well, this is the trucker coming at you from nice, sunny, and warm Arizona. All right, comrades, have a good one. Hope to see you out there on the road, making your scouting trip and your migration soon. Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from Arizona. And you know, I follow a bunch of different podcasts. And, you know, the Northwest is a real nice area to live in. There is housing to be had. Just depends on where you plan on living at. I would definitely stay away from the larger metropolitan areas like Seattle, Tacoma, Olympia, Portland. Doesn't take very far to get outside the reach of those areas. The bigger it is, the farther you have to go out. But me personally, I live over it's about 18 miles as the crow flies west of Seattle there in Bremerton. And over there where I live at and stuff, got, well, over in Seattle, it's even worse. Down in Tacoma and Portland, they've really got it bad down there, is the homeless population. People going and living in tents and under overpasses and in the green belts. They like setting their tents up and tarped shelters in the wooded areas and stuff. And they have a tendency to prey on people out there on the biking and jogging paths. Portland area especially has gotten a new swing on homelessness. Instead of setting up camps in the wooded areas, they are getting a hold of old abandoned boats or just flat out stealing boats and tying them up in wooded area along the bank where they can conceal themselves and living out of the boats. Hey, what better way to go and take care of your business if you need to from a boat? Just hang it over the side and do your business. So I guess the waterways are getting kind of polluted, and the boats are, they don't keep them up necessarily, and so they end up deteriorating themselves. And what boats tend to do, if you don't take care of them, they fill with water and they sink. Then they end up leaking all kinds of different fluids like gasoline or diesel fuel or oil or whatever's in them out of them into the waterways. Yeah, the Northwest isn't exactly a paradise because of the leeches coming up here because they think they can go and get free stuff. No matter what skin color, you'll go and find them out there along the wooded areas and stuff usually. They get pretty good at concealing themselves in, like I say, the wooded areas behind the blackberry and other vines that live up here. They go and conceal themselves fairly well, and they go and live up here right by our Walmart there in East Bremerton. I think it was about a year ago, they had a big clean out. They was told us that we couldn't drop our trailer there for about a month because they had dumpsters set up there to go and clean the homeless camps out of the wooded area in and around the Walmart there. So if you're going to be coming up here, make sure you have money to support yourself and a job lined up and all that. So, all right. Well, this is the Trucker signing off from Arizona. Have a good one, comrades.
We're gonna do what they say can be done. We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm westbound, just watch old bandit run.
All right, we are back with another Radio Free Northwest panel discussion. I'm here with Comrade Jason, Comrade Don Welke, myself, Andy Donner, and Comrade AJ may chime in from time to time. And I wanted to call this panel discussion because some months ago, after Harold died, we were sent a medium-length email letter to Harold's old email address, and it made some interesting critiques of what this person perceives to be white flight as it relates to the Northwest Imperative. And I thought this actually would make an interesting roundtable discussion. So, with that, I will do my best, one, not to criticize this person, because they're very aware of their own hypocrisy, and they make that plain, and I have to respect that, just so we're clear. I won't identify this person, and I won't identify some of their activities in detail, just because I don't want to blow their cover. But it's from someone in California who is planning to leave, and in general, they are talking about their opinions of white flight, enclave building, both in the Northwest and anywhere else someone happens to be, and all of the problems they perceive with white flight as an approach. And Comrade Jason has already pointed out that there's no solution here. I would only add to that that, well, Jason's actually very right. The thing is that there's a significant subtext in this letter, and I don't know that we're going to read the whole thing for you, just because that would be obnoxious. But there's a significant subtext that this person is very much aware of the solution, and the only criticism I could issue of them is that they seem totally unwilling to actually adopt the Northwest Imperative, even if they're perfectly willing to criticize it and claim that we're not doing the very thing we do. Jason actually has some interesting thoughts, so I'll let him go first here.
One of the things I see in here, this person is talking about some of the practical issues with enclave building, the things we need to be doing. We know we need to do these, but one of his complaints is white flight with folks, because they are thinking that they are going to be leaving any particular area. We have no real practice doing this and doing it effectively from the white nationalist perspective, because people already have their foot out the door mentally. And so they won't commit to attempting things in a local area where they live and have ties and roots in order to gain some practice, replacing some of the institutions that have weakened over the years and have gone by the wayside and are actually under attack in our society. Some of the things like various churches and fraternal orders, schools. The small schoolhouse used to be a place where people sent their children and gained a real feel for their own culture, their own civilization, their own national history, and the histories of their peoples. Those things are not anywhere near, like they used to be, the strength of our society any longer. So the fact that those things have gone away, we need to find some way to exercise this muscle that our people naturally did in the past and try to rebuild those types of capabilities in terms of enclave building. And he's got a good point about that. When you are mentally out the door, thinking that you do have some place to run, because whites still, in large measure, have places to flee to in America. The fact that white flight takes place at all is our judgment on our society and what is happening. But the complacency that has allowed us to get to this point also manifests itself in the fact that we are complacent about the fact we still have places to run to. We need to overcome that and figure out a way collectively to rebuild some of these institutions that are going to support us for the future. That's kind of the gist of this. His criticism that Eddie talked about is that as we're not doing this, and we have this idea of the Northwest Front to flee up here, he's talking about the lack of commitment he would get in trying to do this in his location while having not committed to the Northwest Imperative idea in the first place. recognizing that when we do flee somewhere, yes, of course, that's what we need to do. We need to exercise this muscle, reestablish this capability to enclave build. The point of the entire Northwest Imperative is to do that in a properly fertile field, which is here. So the guy's missing that a little bit, but he's bringing up some good points, especially for new people. In the considerations as we all come into white nationalism, begin to learn more and more, start to truly understand our predicament and what must be done. For those folks especially, some of the things in this letter that we're going to talk about are going to be particularly valuable. It'll be old hat to a lot of people in the movement. But once again, spaced repetition is good for new people. It's good for the old hats. It should be a good discussion.
Certainly. And I will say that I don't want to dig this guy and I don't want to down him because his opening paragraph is actually very, very blunt that, hey, I'm criticizing something that I myself am currently doing right now. That sort of clarity is very, very rare among anybody addressing the Northwest Front one way or the other. So I have to tip my hat to the guy that he's at least not trying to yank our chain. So I'm assuming a positive intent here, although some of this is a little bit frustrating simply because parts of his letter towards the end indicate he's read at least one of the Northwest Independence novels. Yet earlier in his letter, one of his medium-length paragraphs closes with the question, "For whites moving, we should ask, what do I want to leave for my children, and what for my neighbor?" Clearly, if he's aware of the Northwest Imperative, because he refers to the Northwest Front in a number of ways through this material, and he talks about Harold's novels, my immediate response to him is, okay, so why are we not thinking about a new, sovereign, independent, all-white nation? As Jason has pointed out, there's a whole lot of, here's the problem, but what's the solution in here? And it's kind of like, why is the Butler Plan not the solution? Is the subtext here, and Don has, in my opinion, very fairly pointed out that he thinks there's very little content in this thing. He seems to look at it as a bunch of words, and I have to point out that his perspective is actually very correct. I suppose I, with my personality and my connection to the Northwest Imperative, subtexts like this scream at me that I'm deliberately ignoring the solution. I think that's what drew me to want to comment on this. Don, would you?
Well, I'd like to make a couple points. One is, which I think has been mentioned, but perhaps not emphasized or made clear enough, is that I think this man is contradicting himself in his letter when he is saying that we should be building these enclaves wherever we happen to be in the United States, rather than coming home to the Northwest, which is the whole idea behind the Northwest Front. Now, that's a major contradiction if he thinks he's Northwest Front supporting and he's arguing we need to build enclaves around the United States. The Northwest Front, the central idea is the Butler Plan, which is moving white nationalists into the Pacific Northwest with the ultimate goal of making a white ethnostate in the Pacific Northwest. The other thing that bothers me about this is that he equates the Northwest Front's Butler Plan with white flight. And they're different. They're not the same thing at all. People who engage in white flight are running away from something and they're just going somewhere they feel more comfortable. They have no clear political motivation. They would never admit they're doing it for racial reasons. So this is not white flight. This is something else entirely. And he's making that fundamental error, I think. Let's also look at what he's advocating. He's advocating building these white enclaves wherever people happen to be, and he doesn't really talk about how to do it. If he talked about how to do it, it would be worthwhile because then you could transfer that to the Northwest, where we need to build these enclaves as a basis for our political organization of the Northwest, but he doesn't say how to do it. So those are the three reasons why I think there's very little here.
I won't disagree with that. My largest concern is that he's doing so deliberately, and I will point out I agree with you that he's contradicting himself, because towards the middle of this letter, there's a very large paragraph. I'm deliberately not disclosing this person's identity, and Jason and I went back and forth about this, and I had some strong words for the author of this material that I'm obviously not going to share on air. But Jason and I went back and forth about this, because I could pick this paragraph to pieces, but there's not a whole lot productive there. It's very difficult to tell exactly what this person's association, if anything at all, was with the Northwest Front or the Northwest Imperative, and this middle paragraph talks about dinners using the word we, in that the most plain reading of this material indicates the author of this letter hosted dinners involving the, he refers to it as our old Northwest Front or Northwest Pioneer Agency, dinners, and he talks about various types of people who attend, and this is Identity Europa folks and Northwest Front folks and others. And in the 3 years he hosted them, the only way to read this correctly is that he did all this in California.
And the trouble is that while the Northwest Front isn't a membership organization, the party's collective stance on that has always been that if there was, in fact, a membership card or a membership status, the first requirement would be your zip code. Okay, I'm not aware of any California zip codes that would put one in the proposed homeland. So, again, I don't want to come down on this person too hard, but as Don says, there's some contradiction here because a lot of these dinners, according to this person's bulky paragraph in the middle of the letter, were geared towards trying to make enclaves where people were, even though this person himself was planning on leaving even then. And in that same paragraph, this guy complains that he couldn't secure commitments. Now, this has always been the party's biggest bugaboo, is that everybody has an opinion about what we should be doing, or how we should act, or what our presentation should be, but they themselves are not willing to come here and do it with us. And my claim to fame, and several other people's claim to fame within the Northwest Front, if such a thing were to exist, is that we kept our mouth shut while we were doing what we needed to do and then started talking. So to put it very politely, this always gets on my nerves because it's the polar opposite of what we're asking people to do, yet this person is somehow in a position to criticize us. And this person seems like a straight shooter, but one of those really important experiences in a teenage boy's life is knowing when you should and shouldn't imply association with someone. Because a large part of this is earning the right to talk about your association with the Northwest Front when this person is doing everything they can to, at the close of their letter, they indicate they're going all over the place except the Northwest. And even though we're somehow wrong for not community building in the Northwest, which is very strange. One thing I will say, I did not click through to this person's links, and Don and Jason have both pointed this out, actually, that there's very little discussion about how to actually make this happen. The author of this letter did, in fact, include links and URLs to various resources that they thought someone should read on the subject. Those are what they are. Except, again, this big bulky paragraph that so got under my skin to read part of it. Quote, anyway, the weakness of the Northwest Front was the same as white flight in general. Unquote. Obviously, that's not true, and Don covered that. But to quote again, especially if you don't live in the immediate homeland area as determined from Bremerton. Unquote. Again, I don't want to pick apart the person's entire letter, or rather his entire letter, since Don will get on me about my grammar. But this guy, he, writes that the immediate homeland area as determined from Bremerton, that makes it seem as if the proposed homeland is rather small when in fact it is not. And this determined from Bremerton thing, he's talking about the Northwest Front headquarters area. The trouble here is that this person very clearly has the perspective that they're some sort of alternate authority on what the Northwest Front is up to. He's critiquing the headquarters group, and Jason's making a funny face, and we'll see what Jason has to say about this. He's very clearly, there's subtext here, but it's screaming that he's critiquing the headquarters group and the headquarters group's authority to decide what is and is not the proposed homeland. He's implicitly setting himself up as some other authority. He's questioning the Northwest Front's authority to make decisions and commentary about the Northwest Front.
That's not what I read, and that's not what I see.
Well, what I would say to that is I'm enjoying breaking down Jason in the most positive way, because obviously Jason, as you've all heard, is newer here, and this could just be time and grade, but I used to have more of Jason's attitudes about some of these things. The issue is that after I saw so much communication, right after I came home and for a couple years after, we got one of these a week. You'll start to see the patterns as you see more of this stuff.
I can accept that as an adjustment to maybe my impressions on it. There are a couple things there and here. I'm certainly much more charitable in my interpretations of what this man is saying. I will admit that straight up front. You know, we don't all see the same things in here. And that's fine. What he means is hack.
Yes.
He meant what Harold and the novels lay out in terms of the vision for what the Northwest American Republic might look like. This sort of opens the question as to what the homeland itself would be, what is viable. He doesn't think either is straightforward.
I have a comment about that, because I've talked to Harold about that issue, and he said explicitly to me that what's suggested in the novels and all this about the core homeland area is just that it's the core, it's the beginning, he says, and we'll grab as much more as we can get.
Absolutely.
That's the simple, yes. Straightforward answer to this guy's complaint.
And again, as Jason points out, spaced repetition matters. A lot of what Jason does is geared towards explaining this to newer people, which is important because I freely admit to what Jason's disagreement with what I just said, I freely admit that I have a much more, I don't want to say jaded and cynical, but I have a much more...
Jaded and cynical works.
Well, it's not necessarily jaded and cynical. It's I've seen more of this, so I'm less appreciative of this type of complaint. But even so, Jason is correct that we do occasionally have to make sure we're communicating what the newer people need to hear and helping them understand, because I freely admit that part of the problem with my perspective on a lot of NF matters is that I've been doing this for so many years that I sometimes forget what it's like to be newer. If I want to keep it on a positive note, assuming this man means well, I would say that the one correction I would give him about this is that he explicitly invokes the Northwest American novels, and part of the problem is that Harold was always clear that those are fiction. In a broad scale, I tend to believe that's still the way things will play out, just as a simple matter of what we think will happen. But there are things in those novels that Harold himself didn't like. Harold was, first and foremost, a creative and an author, and he would occasionally write characters doing things he himself didn't approve of simply because he believed that's what a character would do in a situation. And it's also clear that one thing that we leave out of a lot of our introductory material, and probably correct, but we still should do spaced repetition on, is that we aren't going to get involved in crystal ball gazing, as Harold called it. In the Northwest Independence novels, the Longview Conference and the treaty that came out of it, yes, it included Wyoming as part of the Northwest American Republic, but that was only as a token negotiating gesture on the part of the federal government.
Quickly, before I close this episode of Radio Free Northwest, I'd like to make a quick observation and highlight a continuing trend that is thankfully good. Many of you out there make the effort to stay in regular contact with the party, and it is appreciated. I know Gretchen, for example, has a habit of sending us nice notes on a regular basis. Other people actually take the time to write us very nice cards, and the HQ group and I always appreciate receiving that sort of communication. There's still one sort of communication, though, that we prize above all others, and that is the announcement that someone has come home or that someone has made a scouting trip. Now, for reasons that are obvious, we are very, very careful about discussing this, so we almost never read those things out, unless there's a very, very specific reason for doing so in a particular case. The HQ group just forwarded to me a very nice scouting trip report of a husband and wife couple that went all over the homeland and are working on a plan to actually make their migration happen. And thankfully, they're very, very far from alone. Following Harold's death, I have been simply astounded at the number of people who make sure to stay in close communication with the party while they're undergoing homecoming and homecoming-related activities, and I'm always deeply touched that they're able to convey their reasons for doing so and their heartfelt appreciation for the homeland itself, even after just a simple scouting trip. Thank you, folks, and keep that stuff coming. Radio Free Northwest is brought to you by the Northwest Front, P.O. Box 2188, Bremerton, Washington 98310. You can visit the party on our website at www.northwestfront.org. Until next week, hail victory.